TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Ambassador Chaz Freeman, America's Problematic Policies in Syria. How suddenly Syria's entanglement with all surrounding states becomes the center of world attention. Chaz Freeman's knowledge of the area and history is personal and professional and detailed. In his 30-year career, he served as the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 1989 to 1992 and dealt with the Gulf War. On Friday, December 27, he was interviewed by Nima, an Iranian-Brazilian university lecturer, on his podcast, Dialogue Works. The channel is dedicated to peace. Here are excerpts from their almost one-hour-long conversation.
Let's get started with the situation in Syria. We had a huge rally in Turkey managed by Erdogan's son against Israel. In your opinion, with what we've seen so far in Syria, are we heading toward new sort of conflicts between Israel and Turkey?
I suspect we are. Turkey very much wants to have a united Syria for several reasons. It would be an extension in many ways of Turkish influence because of Turkey's connection with the victorious group that now heads the government. And it would be Sunni, which Turkey also is. And Turkey needs to keep terrorism from infecting Syria again. And it also wants a free hand against the Kurds, whom it regards as terrorists. So it has many, many reasons to want what has happened, what appears to be happening, that is the formation of a united front government that embraces all of the various resistance factions that took Damascus. It wants that to happen, and it wants Turkish influence to be dominant in a united Syria. Israel wants to dismember Syria. It would prefer that it be broken up into many impotent little nationalities or religious communities. And it has always had that objective. It is taking land in Syria, clearly intending eventually to annex it. It is treating Syrians rather badly, as is its normal custom with other Arabs. So I think there's an immediate conflict of interest there. But beyond that, Syrians generally, like others in not just the Arab world, but more broadly in the Islamic world, and I would say now in the global South generally, are very passionate defenders of the abused Palestinians, and therefore anti-Israeli. So Turkey has always seen itself as a protector of the Palestinians. You know, when in earlier efforts by Israel to engage in mass murder in Gaza occurred in previous wars, Turkey was the site of relief efforts, and some Turks died at the hands of Israeli commandos during one of those seaborne efforts. So I think this is now a cockpit of contention between Greater Israel, the Israeli hegemony that has been established in the Levant, and a Turkish neo-Ottomanism, if you will, an extension of Turkish leadership within that region of the Muslim world and beyond it. And so I think, yes, this is going to be a difficult thing for Israel and for Turkey both.
If the conflict gets worse, in your opinion, the Arab states are going to be more in favor of supporting Turkey, or they're going to have some sort of doubt in their mind because we know that how much the United States has leverage on them?
Well, the Turkish relationship with the Arabs historically was a difficult one, of course. The Ottoman ruler of Egypt, an Albanian in the Turkish Empire, knocked off the first Saudi dynasty in Saudi Arabia. Turkey controlled the little emirates that are now so powerful because of oil on the western and southern side of the Persian Gulf. It controlled the Hejaz, Mecca, Medina, the city of Jeddah in what is now the western province of Saudi Arabia. And of course, in World War I, Lawrence of Arabia famously led or joined with the Arabs to try to liberate them from the Ottomans and ultimately from European imperialism. He failed. European imperialism replaced the Ottoman imperialism. And I think this was very unpleasant for the Arabs generally. The Ottomans, what everyone says about them, had been tolerant of diversity. They did not insist on uniformity. They allowed many communities to coexist and to rule themselves. They were very hands-off, unless there was a direct challenge to their authority. And of course, during the Ottoman period, there was a caliph in Istanbul, that is a successor to the Prophet Muhammad in the Sunni view at any rate. So this is a very tangled history. And more recently, Turkey has been, for example, very close to Qatar, when Qatar had a very difficult, hostile relationship with the United Arab Emirates and with Saudi Arabia. And it continues to have a relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is outlawed everywhere in the Gulf and in Egypt. I think, you know, the group that is taking control in Damascus is indeed connected to the Muslim Brotherhood, although a rather extreme version of it. So this is very difficult for the Arabs and the Turks. Having said that, I believe that they share an opposition to what Israel is doing to the Palestinians and to the region. And in fact, the Gulf Arabs are drawing closer to Iran now, out of fear of Israel. And the American relationship with them continues, but now it's on a very wary, apprehensive basis because of the American backing of genocide in Gaza and the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, which the United States claims to oppose, but does nothing substantial to demonstrate that opposition. So the Turks, of course, are connected to the United States through NATO. And I think I've said before, the United States ignores Turkey or does not work with it to its detriment, because you really cannot conduct any policy toward Iran, Iraq, Syria, Israel, Palestine, Afghanistan, Central Asia, the Caucasus, the Black Sea, Russia, the European Union, Greece, Cyprus, the Balkans, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation member countries, without Turkey. This is a country that is connected in multiple ways to many, many geopolitically important zones and issues. But American relations with Ankara are pretty bad and have been for a long time. Israel seems to be able to get away with crossing the United States and doing the opposite of what the United States advises it to do. Turkey has been less successful at this. So the American connection is an ambivalent, ambiguous one in this context. And finally, I guess I'd say, of course, Israel has achieved a kind of hegemony in its region. It brings to mind the statement in the New Testament, I think it's in Matthew, but I might be wrong about that. I'm not a biblical scholar, in which it is said, what shall it profit a man if he should gain the world and lose his own soul? Israel has gained part of the world, but it has lost its soul. and it is no longer acceptable company pretty much anywhere except a few countries in the collective West, with my own as the chief among them.
Erdogan, the other problem right now in Syria is the, as you mentioned, with the Kurds, that the United States is supporting them, Erdogan is against them. Erdogan said recently, just yesterday, if I'm not mistaken, said that the Kurds must either disarm or face being buried in Syria. Here comes the crucial decision on the part of the United States. What they're going to do about the Kurds? How are they going to talk about the situation they're having right now with Turkey? Are they going to confront Turkey? Are they going to continue the same sort, the same kind of policy that we've seen so far, or they're going to change that attitude?
Well, I'm sorry to say there's a long history here of betrayal of the Kurds by the United States. For example, at the negotiations in Versailles to end World War I, when they were denied self-determination, which they felt they had a right to have. And when the Ottoman Empire was dismembered, but they were not given their own independent place in the new order. It seems that on average, the United States or the West betrays the Kurds 4 times a century. Well, we're about 1/4 into this 21st century, and it's probably time for another betrayal. So we remember what Mr. Trump said when he was in office. He wanted to get out of Syria and abandon the Kurds. And the deep state, he says, prevented him. And eventually he had to justify the illegal presence of the Americans in Syria, because we control the oil. And presumably we are marketing the oil, and in fact, largely to Israel. So I think based on history, the Kurds have a very poor chance of sustaining American support.
If Donald Trump decides to have some sort of compromise with Turkey on the issue of Kurds, what do they want in return from Turkey?
What would the United States want?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we're in a position really to do a bargain like that. But assuming we did, I presume what we would want would be Turkish support against Russia. But I don't think the Turks are going to give us that. They have determined that it's in their interest to have an independent foreign policy and not to follow the U.S. lead or the NATO consensus on Russia. And they are therefore in a small camp within NATO that includes countries like Hungary and Slovakia, others as well, but those two stand out. Romania now, I think, after the voided elections, which don't believe in the war in Ukraine and want to see it end. And in fact, Turkey has been very helpful in the past in bringing Russians and Ukrainians together. It did that in March and April of 2022, right after the war started. Or the international Russian element of it started, because it had been a civil war earlier. And so I think there's not going to be a bargain on this point. The Turks are pretty formidable as a military. No one likes to fight them because they are very tough and very accomplished. And this is a big, important country with all of the international connections that I mentioned. And like everyone else in the region, whether it's Iran or earlier Israel, Israel actually had to back off its relations with China and be careful about its relations with Russia because it is so dependent on the United States. Turkey has not backed off, nor has Saudi Arabia, nor has the United Arab Emirates, and certainly Iran has not. So we see every country in West Asia independently reaching out to rising powers like China, India, Russia, Brazil, and others. And we see some American East Asian allies like South Korea very active in competing for arms sales and other advantages in West Asia. So I don't think the Middle East, if you will, the West Asia that President-elect Trump will inherit bears very little resemblance to the one that he saw when he was in office. And American leverage and influence is greatly reduced. So I don't know that he can do any sort of deal with Turkey. And the Turks are determined. The Turks have a domestic reason, namely, you know, PKK terrorism, which is real. It's not an imaginary thing that the Kurdish Workers' Party in Turkey has engaged in terrorism. Sometimes they've been on the verge of giving it up, but they never have. And the Turks see the Kurds in Syria as very much allied with the PKK. So I don't think they're going to be kind to them at all.
The other doubt right now is in what's going on in the Middle East with Iran. Do you think that Donald Trump is going to make a new deal between the United States and Iran? Because we know how much Netanyahu and his administration and his ilk, and the people who's from the same type of mindset, are against any sort of deal between the United States and Iran.
I don't think there's political support in the United States for a renewal of the JCPOA, which would in fact be the most sensible way to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear bomb, which so far it doesn't seem to have decided to do. And we've discussed before the fact that because Israel has rolled up Hamas and greatly weakened Hezbollah, and these were the frontline defense of Iran, along with a pipeline of support to Hezbollah through Syria, which is now broken. Because Iran has been stripped of its major defenses against an Israeli attack, and this puts pressure on it to go nuclear, much greater than before. There are people in Mr. Trump's entourage who think Taiwan ought to go nuclear, who think South Korea should go nuclear. I don't know how much opposition they have to Iran going nuclear. So I can't say what he will do. But there's no indication that he deviates at all from Mr. Netanyahu's line on Iran, which is completely hostile and dedicated to not just weakening Iran, but engaging in regime change there. I would like to be more optimistic, but I don't see a basis for optimism at the moment. In fact, I think we're in a very dangerous period while Mr. Biden is still in office. Mr. Trump has now come into office. Mr. Netanyahu wants to go to war with Iran. He's completely contemptuous of Mr. Biden and has shown this on numerous occasions. He doesn't want to cross Mr. Trump, but apparently he's in frequent contact with him and claims that they see eye to eye on Iran.
Ambassador, how do you find the situation in the West Bank? And the Palestinian Authority are against the people in the West Bank. There seems to be some sort of conflict within the Palestinians. And how much of what's going on there is related to Israel and their policies?
Well, a great deal is related to Israel and its policies, because, in effect, the Palestinian Authority has been the capo, the in-house trusted element of the Israeli imprisonment of the Palestinians and persecution of them. And the most recent demonstration of this is the PA's attacks on Jenin and the refugee camp there, which is not sympathetic to the PA, much more hardline resistance. And the Palestinian police are basically doing Israel's job for it in suppressing the resistance there. This brings, I read an editorial in the Boston Globe the other day, which I thought was a bit absurd, but it ended up saying, well, there needs to be a two-state solution, although it didn't explain how that could happen. But, you know, in order for that to happen, the Palestinians have to have someone who can speak for them, and there's nobody to negotiate with. To which my reaction was, yes, that's true, because Israel has murdered everybody who might have negotiated with it, whether they were members of Hamas or some other group, including the PLO. Some 3,000 assassinations have taken place. So Israel has basically adopted an historical policy of trying to ensure that it is able to say truthfully, there is no one to negotiate with because it has murdered everyone it might negotiate with. The exception is Marwan Barghouti, who is imprisoned and apparently currently being abused.
One of the big problems right now for Israel is Houthis and what's going on with Yemenis and Ansarullah, they're called. Do you think that Donald Trump can change the game in favor of Israel in considering Houthis and maybe Saudi Arabia and UAE joining?
I think at this point, the Houthis are seen widely in the Islamic world as heroic. They are the only group, government, if you will. Ansarullah is the effective government in the most populated parts of Yemen. The unpopulated parts are dominated by other factions with other backers. Ansarullah is, or the Houthis are their own movement. It's always said Iranian backed. That's true. But Iran supports them. It doesn't guide them. It does not direct them. So it really doesn't tell you anything useful to say Iran backed Houthis. So what could Israel and the United States do? More to probably cut off Iranian support to the Houthis. But, you know, Yemen has been bombed and strafed and invaded and fought with for, what, a decade or more. And nothing has succeeded in conquering the Houthis. I don't think there's much we can do. The United States and Great Britain have been in the Red Sea trying to protect shipping headed for Israel from Houthi reprisals, and they have not succeeded. And in fact, the Houthis have conducted the first land-based sea blockade of Israel. And now, of course, they are retaliating against Israeli abuses of the Palestinians by firing rockets into Israel. And I think they have said, and I believe them, they are not going to give up. And so I don't think there's much to be done about this. The Israelis, by bombing Yemen, will, I think, have the same experience as the Saudis did when they did that. Which brings me to your question about whether the Saudis and Emiratis would join in suppressing the Houthis. No, because why would they do that on behalf of Israel? You know, the United States doesn't have a quarrel with Yemen except to the extent it joins with Israel in such a confrontation. The populace, the people in these countries, although they don't have much of a voice in politics, are adamantly anti-Israeli. And I think, you know, there are what I consider to be truly silly conversations going on between Israelis and people outside Israel in the United States. They're talking about normalization with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is going to, you know, in return for some kind of Bantustan being created in the West Bank and a part of Gaza being left to the Palestinians, the Saudis will somehow normalize relations with Israel and pay for everything. You know, and this is not going to happen. If that were attempted by Mohammed bin Salman, assuming he was tempted by it, which I don't think he is, if he were to try that, there would be a very good chance of a revolution against the al-Saud, probably led by another member of the al-Saud, since they have all bases covered. You know, this is not Iran. If there were a revolution in Saudi Arabia, it would be led by one member of the family against the rest of the family. In fact, in some ways, Mohammed bin Salman has done that. So I think we're talking about a very different political animal than, let's say, Syria with all of its divisions or Iran with its heritage of Shiism.
Ambassador, it seems that in Ukraine, they're sending a lot of weapons right now and aid to Ukraine. The question is, when the Ukrainian army is not capable to fight against Russia. Who's going to fight that? Is that going to be European countries sending their troops or maybe mercenaries, new mercenaries to the conflict?
No, that is not going to happen. And Mr. Trump is quite clear that he does not want to send U.S. troops. In fact, the latest polling data in Europe shows a very strong reduction in support for less sticking with Ukraine until it, quote, wins, unquote. There's rising support for a negotiated solution, which will inevitably have to be mostly on Russian terms. Furthermore, I don't know whether to believe this or not, but I just watched a clip in France from a French reporter in Kursk in the Ukrainian salient inside Russia. And what he describes is a disaster. He says in his unit, 75% of the men have defected. Why? Because they are being asked to be cannon fodder. They are artillerymen and other specialties. They're being asked to charge defensive positions the Russians have set up as infantry. And this is suicide. This is a mess. And it's part of a broader pattern in which the Russians continue to advance across the broad front inside Ukraine. And nobody is in a position to stop them. This isn't about weapons, it's about manpower. The Ukrainians have shown enormous willpower. One has to greatly respect them for their bravery on the battlefield, but there are limits to what human beings can do, and they have reached them. So we are now hearing more and more talk about negotiations. And I note that Prime Minister Fico of Slovakia was just in Moscow and offered Slovakia as a venue for such negotiations. And Mr. Putin said that would be fine because Slovakia has adopted a neutral position. So I think the Russians are open to a negotiation. So far, the Ukrainians and the West are not, but time is running out.
You heard excerpts from an interview of the retired ambassador, Chaz Freeman, recorded on December 27, 2024. Freeman served in the United States Foreign Service and the State and Defense Departments over the course of 30 years. He was interviewed by Nima, an Iranian-Brazilian university lecturer who hosts the podcast called Dialogue Works. You can hear the full 53-minute long program on the YouTube channel Dialogue Works under the title Ambassador Chaz Freeman, America's Problematic Policies. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelerden. Thank you for listening.